Thank you for joining us today. My name is Brad Miller, and you've joined the Chronically Human podcast. And we have conversations that aim at advancing human civilization. Today, our episode is brought to you by libertyforyou.com, where you can find t-shirts and mugs with ideas worth sharing. That's L-I-B-E-R-T-E-E, the number four, the letter U.com. My guest today is Dr. Thomas Klein. He's been a doctor for 42 years with long-term diseases. He's worked with Harvard Med. He had his residency at Stanford, and he worked at Boston Children's Hospital. He also has a PhD from the University of Oregon. And above all, he's a very compassionate man. Dr. Klein has been on the front lines on Twitter as well as across the internet on sites like Medium.com, Huffington Post, and Pain News Network, advocating on the side of a forgotten group in society in which I'm a part of. And that's chronic pain patients whose lives have been negatively impacted by the opioid hysteria in the country. First of all, Dr. Klein, I want to thank you for your advocacy for what you're doing. And I think you do it with a lot of class. You come at it from a place of compassion. And you also are really strong with the facts. And that's why I wanted to have you on here today, because I think that the FDA and the CDC are really having trouble with facts, it seems like, today.
Correct.
Well, we'll start off, Dr. Klein. I'd just like to ask you, what led you to get into medicine?
10th grade biology class. I became immensely interested in biology, and I thought medicine would be a good way to apply basic science, and I still do that.
Oh, fantastic. Are you still a practicing doctor?
Yes.
Okay, so you see patients and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I'm in the process of retiring, but I still have a small patient load, yes.
I got you. Yeah, 42 years is a long time, definitely. So I'm sure you have a lot of long-term patients.
Yes, I do.
Gotcha. Fantastic. Well, what led you to become an advocate for people in pain?
Last year, about this time, actually it was April, a year and 3 months, I was reading some stuff on the internet, and it dawned on me that the CDC was going to come and sit in my office and tell me how to practice medicine. So I started to look into it, and I read and tried to read the CDC guidelines, tried to read is the keyword, 50 pages, single space. The word obfuscation kept popping into my brain. Like, you know, this is just about one topic. You know, I mean, you could discuss the use of opiates in a textbook, you know, like a pharmacology textbook in 3 pages. Why 50 pages? It was odd. And then I began checking some of their references and some of their logic and their critical thinking. And I'm afraid it's just bunk.
Well, that's a good word for it, Dr. Klein. I think when you have to use 50 pages to explain something specific, you are purposely, I think, personally, trying to hide something. What do you think is the purpose or the motivation behind what these folks are doing, the bureaucrats, the media, and then those certain industries like that are looking to benefit from these type of regulations?
We've had a fear of opiates for over 100 years. In 1915, the opiophobes passed a law called the Harrison Act that taxed opium products. At that time, you could go to the store and buy most things. You could not buy morphine, but you could buy laudanum and you could buy opium products.
Right.
So when they started taxing opium, guess what happened? Oops, up went the price. So what happens when the price goes up is the generation of a black market. Because the black market has the supply and can offer it at a high price, but at least there's some there. It was pretty much drying up. The Harrison Act was a tax act, you know, to try to tax opium, which was a dumb idea. There was a state recently that tried to do that, also a dumb idea.
Oh, wow.
But the Harrison Act was written in such a way that the Federal Narcotics Police, at that time was part of the Treasury Department. You remember the Untouchables and Elliot Ness. He was part of that for alcohol. And so then they had a little narcotics bureau. So the way they read the Harrison Act, they said, you know, these doctors are illegally treating addicts. They weren't heroin addicts at the time. They were morphine addicts. And so let's arrest them. And they did. They started arresting doctors and putting them in jail and finding them money. And the doctors said, hey, you know, forget it. I'm not going to be prescribing any more opiates. Ooh, more black market. Then heroin came on the streets because it was cheap. And you could get it, and it worked very well. It's a medicine called diamorphine. It's used in all the countries in the world, except the United States, where it's considered to be possessed by the devil. So that's how you got to realize that this goes back more than 100 years. And what was it based on? I mean, why were the police arresting doctors for treating people with addiction disease? Well, guess what? Yesterday, I read about a doctor in the United States arrested for treating a person with addiction disease. It's still there. Because if we give opiates to dope fiends, we're just making it worse. So all we have to do is just make all the opiates disappear, and all the addicts will go, oh, rats, I can't find any more of this. So you know what? I think I'll just start going to church and get a job. Doesn't work that way, not with addiction disease. Addiction disease is a very, very powerful thing. And because of some folks back in the 1930s, a guy named Henry Anslinger, who ran the Narcotics Bureau for 32 years and who made marijuana a federal crime, and who's the one who started stories about doped-up Negroes, as he said, taking white women off and God only knows doing what to them. So he generated a lot of these stories. He also generated some really vicious stories about how people, this one family, the fellow on dope, as he called it, axe murdered his whole family. Well, they found out later he wasn't on dope at all. Henry Anslinger disclassified dope as anything. So he, the movie, the famous movie in 1936, Reefer Madness, guess what? The government helped produce the movie. So he felt that dope, which was marijuana, cocaine, and opiates, really were totally evil because they caused social problems and crime and sex crimes and people. Chinese people started to run off with white women, and black folks started to run off with white women. And believe me, the average Chinese person is not interested in running off white women, nor the average black person interested in running off with white women. So he had 32 years to create this horrible thing that's now woven into our fabric. And what it is people believe that being a dope fiend is the worst possible thing in the United States. There were two guys caught in North Carolina recently running a cocaine ring out of their double wide. And these guys were crooks, and they caught them. And one was 42 and one was 45. They got sentenced to life.
Wow.
For selling cocaine. Now, that's a bad thing. You're breaking the law. You know, I've asked a couple of people, if you were a judge, what would you send them? One person said 3 years, the other person said 5 years. So you see, we're so afraid of drugs that cause you to lose your inhibitions. And when you lose your inhibitions, God only knows what you do. So the average person on the street thinks that this is really awful. And a way to test that is to ask the question, if two treated, addicted people and their children moved in next door to you, what would you think? And I asked one college student, and she thought about it a minute, and she said, fear. That was a perfect answer. In other words, it's diffuse fear. It's hard to put your finger on it.
Is it because I'm sorry, Dr. Klein. Is it because of the unpredictability, do you think, that people feel that people taking drugs, they don't fit into the societal norms, and so you can't really predict how they're going to behave or react to situations?
Perfect. That's a perfect description. Unpredictability. It's like bears. Anybody who's around big Alaskan bears knows they just sit there and look at you, but they're extremely unpredictable. And they'll just suddenly come at you for no reason after just lounging around and doing nothing. And that's it, Brad. That's a real good word. These people are unpredictable. And, you know, the facts of the case are that opiate painkillers make people drowsy and sleepy and they nod off, right? They're not running around doing anything unpredictable. I asked one guy who was an ex-addict of 20 years. I said, what about all these sex crimes you hear about? He says, you kidding me? We're just nodding off. Nobody wants to have sex. What about crime? And he said, you know, he was on the streets for 15 years. And, yeah, you know, they tried to steal in stores and sell the stuff, manipulate doctors, manipulate their family. So they kind of become a horrible pain in the rear. But serious crime does not occur with opiate addiction. As a matter of fact, the studies show that the number one drug, and he agreed, that's associated with violent crime is alcohol.
Alcohol, definitely. And that you can go to any, basically any store and get that.
That's right. Nobody's running around arresting distillers, you know, for making this stuff. And the deaths from alcoholism, you know, they say, oh, there's 50 people a day dying from overdoses, by the way, all in addiction communities. Actually, there's 200 dying from alcohol-related disease. And you ready for this? Guess what it is with tobacco?
I'm not sure.
1,200.
Wow.
People die a day from tobacco-related disease.
That's
50
insane.
Die a day. You see, they always quote this 50.
Right.
People are dying every day from overdoses, and they never put it in a perspective. Actually, the number of people dying from opioid overdoses is about the same as people who die from choking.
Well, you don't.
It doesn't even make the top 15 commonest causes of death. So, yeah, people are dying, and we're all afraid of that because we don't want our teenage sons and daughters to end up dead because some doctor gave him medicines and didn't know what he was doing. And that's true.
And I've actually, you know, I'm for opioid medications. I've been in chronic pain for 30 years. But I do have a friend of a friend who took their niece to, like, an emergent care center. And they did give her too much. I think it was Demerol or Dilaudid. And the young lady died. So I think those stories are so rare, but they're so powerful that I think sometimes they can counteract common sense and even the facts like you're presenting today.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, when I see a patient and I have can give them a drug and I'm going to say, now, I got to warn you, you know, this could have serious consequences. It could suppress your bone marrow. You know, we have to give you special medicines to bail you out. And then the next question the patient should ask, and if they don't, I supply it, is how often will this happen?
Right. Frequency.
Frequency. And now then it's up to the patient to decide, you know, you're going to get this benefit, but you may have this horrible side effect. It's up to you, George. You decide. I'm giving you all the facts. You decide. So with opiates, you have a chance of 1 in 250 of developing an addiction. It's a bad side effect, like suppressing a bone marrow. It's a terrible disease. But there's a real simple way to diagnose it early. 90% of addiction starts in high school. Why is that? Oh, the high school brain is rough. No. There's a simpler explanation. High school is the time when you first get exposed to opiates. Oxys, usually, oxycodone at parties. High school students basically have access to almost anything. The retail street drug business is set up. They're all real nice and they sell people stuff and they make a lot of money. And they don't want their clients dying. It's bad for business. So it's 1 in 250. So we have a high school here in North Carolina. It's got 1,000 students. So you would predict about 4 or 5 will have the gene for opiate addiction. And if you give them an opiate, the very first pill, they're going to have a celestial carpet ride. And believe it or not, the other 996 kids who take opiates are not going to get high. They're going to feel relaxed, but they're not going to go on a magic carpet ride. So what we need to teach kids in high school is if you're at some party and some kid's over in the corner going, "Whoa, man, this is the best thing in my life. This is the best thing that's ever happened to me." And they're taking an opiate. That's a signal. Now, what doctors need to do, and they're not doing, is understand that you can't just addict anybody in the population. You have to have the gene first. If people run around eating a lot of donuts, are they going to get diabetes? No. If they run around and eat a lot of donuts and they have the gene for diabetes, are they going to get it? Yep. Nothing to do with the donuts. You know, you just have the gene. If you don't have the gene for addiction, and it does run in families, you will never, ever become addicted, no matter what you take. How do we know that? In 1974, when I was at Stanford University, we were doing a study along with a very famous person from St. Louis, a woman by the name of Robbins. And for the Army, we were looking at, what are we going to do with all these people coming back from Vietnam hooked on this high-dose heroin? So we took them all off, and they went through the withdrawal like people do with cigarettes and like people, all people do who take opiates longer than about 3 weeks. So you go through a withdrawal. Everybody does that. The question was, out of 100 people all going through withdrawals, all on IV pure heroin, how many ended up becoming street addicts? Well, you would assume it'd be 100.
Right. That's 80. That's the image that you get.
The image you get, I mean, this is intravenous heroin now. Right. You know, this is not oxycodone pills. 2 people out of 100
Wow.
Developed a street addiction. And the researcher was clever enough to say that it probably wasn't even that high because she suspected some people with addiction disease signed up for the Army and volunteered to go to Vietnam in order to get this. You know, it was $3. You could get 160 milligrams of pure heroin. Guess how many GIs died from overdose of heroin?
I'm not sure.
We can't find any data in the Army. Not that the Army is the most forthcoming with data. But it appears that overdose deaths with heroin in Vietnam almost were non-existent. And so why is that? Well, number one, a lot of people taking the heroin were not really addicted, so they didn't need enormous doses. They just, you know, felt kind of relaxed. But the other thing is they knew how many milligrams they were taking. You see, the problem with street addiction is that, you know, people have to get their medicines for their addiction disease, and they have no idea what's in it. You know, is there fentanyl in it? Who knows? You know, has it been laced with this or that? So people on the streets die from either impure heroin, and mainly they die because they're trying to boost the effects, because they're not finding pure enough heroin, so they take Phenergan, which is a cough syrup. They take antidepressants. They take benzodiazepines. They take cocaine. And most frequently, they take alcohol. So you start piling your body with all this stuff at whatever dose you feel like, and 2% of street addicts die every year. And that's really sad. And it's because we have made them lepers. People with addiction disease don't go to doctors. They don't have go to emergency rooms. Are you kidding me? They get no medical care, whether they've got a cold or pneumonia or broken leg. They just don't go because they're going to be arrested. So we have created this system that if you are unpredictable, like you said, Brad, you're unpredictable and you live off behind these dumpsters and you have no connection with the community. How many people have actually met a person with addiction disease?
I don't think I've ever met somebody.
Personally. Well, I went out of my way to meet people during this last year when I became concerned about this issue.
Right.
And lo and behold, these are everyday folks with the gene. who got, most of them got accidentally nailed when they were in high school. So if you've got four people per thousand with addiction disease, or let's say five people per thousand, that's a half of 1%, and most all of them get addicted in high school, that only leaves maybe one person per thousand running around who can actually become addicted. So if you gave 1,000 people at Walmart a bag of heroin or oxycodone, doesn't matter what, they're all the same, there's only going to be one person that actually develops the serious addiction disease, which I call addiction B, which we'll explain later.
Okay.
So what we're doing is we are attacking people like yourself who take opiates. 999 people out of 1,000 are never going to become addicted. So what are we doing? Well, we're working off of fear because of the unpredictability and the dangerousness of these folks who really are not that dangerous. And if we sat down and talked to them, which I'm going to try to do on air, and understand that these were folks that developed a disease which was not their fault. Were they trying to get high? Well, I don't know. They could have been at a party trying to get high on everything. You can get high on some things. You can get high on marijuana. You can get high on cocaine, alcohol, amphetamines. But that's addiction A. That's a different kind of addiction. It's still an addiction. But it's not a hardcore brain addiction like you get with opiates and, incidentally, nicotine. Those are the two serious type B addictions.
Is that because of the receptors in the brain, how they work?
Exactly. We have receptors in our brain, and they just go kluflooey. It's a genetic change we call polymorphisms, which is our word for a mistake. There's a mistake in the genetics that creates these receptors. You got to have these receptors. You can't get through life without your own endorphins, you know, telling you, yeah, it's good to run, you know. It's healthy and it's good to have sex because, you know, if people didn't feel great after having sex, we'd have pretty crappy human race, like zero. So those receptors are real important. When you drink water, you know immediately you're okay. You eat food, you feel good afterwards. In other words, those are the things that keep us alive. And those little receptors there have to be just right. And in addiction disease, they are not right. Instead of responding to opiates normally, they just go crazy. You know, it's like a big fireworks display. It's not their fault. It's not their fault. And people say, why can't they just stop doing this? And this is the same chubby person that I talk to, goes on a diet every 2 weeks and then hits the refrigerator at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, gorging.
Addicted to carbs and sugar.
Exactly. You know, and then people are real critical, say, well, how come these people just can't stop? Well, how come you can't stop eating?
People,
you know,
like to
I
be
mean, come on here, you know, have a little compassion. It's a weird disease, but it is a disease. And it can be nailed quickly in high school by teaching kids because 80% of addiction does not start with a prescription. It starts with a prescription drug. See how they kind of, you know, play the little three-card Monty. They die of prescription drugs, but whether or not they were prescribed by a doctor is the question. Only 20%. And doctors need to start asking people, and people need to start warning their doctor. Say, look, I've never had an opiate in my life. And so then you know you're on the list for a possible addiction. And if it occurs and you feel like you've gone on this magic carpet ride, you call the doctor immediately because that's the start of a very serious disease, addiction type B, opioid addiction. So back to type A, if you want, if you've been smoking dope every day for 2 years, like somebody that I interviewed, and you go for rehab and you work out all the problems in your life and you stop the medicine, you're fine. You don't have a withdrawal. It's very easy that rehab works and figures out your problems about why you felt like you needed to do this every single day for 2 years. So it's a little bit lighter type of addiction, still addiction. But they're actually more dangerous. Weed is not dangerous. Marijuana is not dangerous. No, nobody's ever died from marijuana, and most people don't cause any crime, but cocaine, alcohol, and amphetamines, those will change your personality. They can turn you into a psychotic individual. Those people can be dangerous. Opiates do not affect your personality. So what we're afraid of is really the wrong thing. So we are treating a problem with a solution that does not match the problem. Type B addiction needs to be treated by doctors, and everybody else needs to keep their hands off. You know, they made heroin illegal in 1925, but what it did is it removed a very important pain medicine we had. The DEA made Vicodin class 2 drug, which means we can't phone it in. I can't tell you what my practice of medicine is like, not being able to call a pharmacist and call in a prescription.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about, too, is the doctor side. I've experienced the last 30 years of the ever-tightening noose around my neck, so to speak, for being a pain patient and seeking relief from my pain. And I've been told flat out that doctors, they were getting letters from like the DEA, and they were concerned. Most recently, I was told that a doctor didn't feel comfortable prescribing me pain medicine. Basically, in my opinion, he was afraid of losing his license or the extra scrutiny. What is it like for doctors today practicing medicine, trying to help people?
It's pretty horrible. The arrests of doctors, raids on doctors, just like it was in 1915. And also in 1930, Henry Anslinger, the drug czar I was telling you about, he arrested 10,000 doctors.
Oh, wow.
Because we're the purveyor of the contaminated demonic substance. See, we're the only ones that can give it to people legally. So the problem is, you know, that we go to medical, we go to college 4 years, medical school 4 years, and then usually 3 years of training. So that's 11 years you put into it. You don't start working really until you're in your early 30s. And the problem is that doctors like myself, if we lose our livelihood, I don't even know how to drive a cab. You know, one guy who lost his license wanted to become an EMT, and they wouldn't let him. You know, so you're finished. You know, here you know, we do make a little more money than people working at McDonald's, which is too bad. I mean, they ought to all be making $15 an hour, but we won't get into that. So, you know, doctors have kids in college, and they have larger homes, and all of a sudden they have no income. It's really pretty grim. And it's done capriciously. The DEA has a lot of power, and they're the federal police, and they can come in and close you down. And then you're scattered, you're running around trying to get a lawyer and everything. It's really difficult. The legal fees are astronomical because dealing in federal court is high. The medical boards across the country, some of them are great, and some of them are really awful. Well, like this one guy, he treated an addict out of compassion, and they just took his license away from him forever. No hearing.
So there's no recourse for a doctor with, I don't understand personally the state medical board, versus like the DEA authority. How does that differ? Who's overseeing like the prescription pain pill deal? Is it the state boards or is it the DEA or a combination of the two?
It's a combination. Normally, according to the Supreme Court decision that reversed the doctors that were arrested in 1915, the Supreme Court decision was 10 years later in 1925. And what the Supreme Court said unanimously is the federal government has no business in the practice of medicine. It's a state issue. So for me to practice medicine in North Carolina, I have to get a license from the Board of Medicine in North Carolina. And that's the way it is around the world. That's the way it is in Canada. But in this country, because of the fear of dope fiends, there's a whole nother agency, the DEA, we have to get a license from. So we have to get an additional license in order to prescribe controlled substances.
And that's a fee you have to pay like every 2 years. Is that correct?
Yeah, but it's $700 every 2 years.
Gotcha.
Then they come and raid me.
Have you been raided personally?
No, I haven't been. You know, I'm following the rules, but that doesn't make any difference. Right. You know, a lot of doctors follow the rules. And They just really, they can just do whatever they want.
Well,
because you
like,
see, nobody complains. Oh, thank right. God you're controlling the dope fiends, you know, in the unpredictability of these fiends, and we're not going to intervene. You know, even juries, very difficult. There was one doctor up in Montana. One of his patients, he prescribed two opiates to his patient. The patient went and got four more drugs, took them all at once, and killed himself because he wanted to commit suicide. So they said because the doctor had prescribed these opiates, he was partially responsible. Guess what? A jury found him guilty of manslaughter.
That's terrible.
So it's not just the boards and the DEA. It's the citizens out there running down the street with pitchforks and torches. So one of the things that I've been trying to do, and you're helping out, Brad, is to let people know what the truth is. There's nothing in it for me to be fibbing. I don't take money from anybody. Wish I did, but I don't.
I don't either.
you don't either. You know, so the average person on the street needs to understand that this fear has led to legislation, has led to Attorney General telling the people to go get those doctors, and now it's affecting them. Not only them, but everybody in the future. In Oregon, they are trying to take everybody off pain medicine who has a chronic, long-term, painful disease, who's on Medicaid. I mean, this is really getting serious.
And doesn't Medicaid and Medicare set the standard that the other insurance companies then follow?
Yes, exactly. As soon as Medicare does something, everybody else does it. So they're kind of the leaders. And, you know, in a competitive market, if you're selling bananas for a dollar, then everybody else sells them for a dollar, you know. And that's the way it is with Medicare.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, I didn't know how that works, so I appreciate you letting us know about that. Now, I did read a couple of your articles on Medium.com. How long have you been writing on that platform?
About 6 months, I think.
Gotcha. And the one article that I read that really touched me and I actually teared up because I could really relate to it was you listed the stories, I think, of 33 people who took their own lives because of being denied pain medicine or not getting enough pain medicine to treat their pain. What are you hearing from people about suicide and how that's affecting not just the person, but when somebody takes their own life, it's a ripple effect that affects, you know, the 10 closest people, and it's just something really terrible.
It is terrible, and I also practice psychiatry a little bit, and, you know, we've been struggling with people committing suicide forever, and it's a very difficult thing to intervene with. It's partly a mental illness. You know, when a person kills themselves, they frequently don't think they're really killing themselves. They think they're just kind of relieving this internal pain. And, you know, be sure to put the cat out in the morning. It's a very, very difficult thing, but we have a new kind of suicide. We have a suicide where people are purposely taken off their medication without their consent and forced back into their terrible pain previously relieved. Pain from different diseases, not pain from outer space. You know, I've got 21,000 people following me on Twitter now, and that's occurred just in the last year. And not a single person that I have read about or talked to or tweeted has imaginary pain. Everybody's got real disease. In other words, these are real, rare type diseases. Arachnoiditis, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, interstitial cystitis, terrible out-of-control arthritis, failed back surgery, very common. You go to, you know, to a surgeon and they make your back worse. Oh, too bad. Take some Tylenol. You know, live with it.
And there's
see if you can put up with it.
There's really no responsibility or accountability, I guess I would say, for some of these procedures that, you know, you have a certain amount of them that won't go well, you know, just by the statistics. And then the bureaucrats don't have any accountability either by passing all these rules, and the politicians either. And it seems like with no skin in the game, that a lot of people can just dismiss pain that other people are in.
Yeah, it's, you know, I said once when the doctor says, oh, I don't think you're in much pain, just leap over the desk and dislocate their shoulder and say, hey, you want some Tylenol? It's hard for me to imagine as a physician of 40 years that doctors are having a hard time understanding what pain is. For God's sake, is this kind of like too difficult to understand? I read this horrible article out of Portland, Oregon, where they were showing how the new treatments and new education amongst the medical students is now working. And they gave the example of a woman who was complaining of pain around her post-operative surgical scar. And the medical student thought, oh, we should look into this. But no, the teacher of the medical student says, oh you fool, she's just drug-seeking. People don't have pain around their surgical incisions this long.
Wow.
They called the patient a liar and said that without even examining her, drug seeker. You see, the drug seeker is our new enemy. The new public enemy number one is the drug seeker.
It's almost like drug seekers are heretics, that they don't fit into the establishment or the norms of society. And it's almost like an inquisition to a certain degree against doctors, as sort of like a medical priest, if you will, and their parishioners, who would be people who need opioid pain medicine. And it has that feel of a religious crusade, it seems like.
You hit the nail on the head there, Brad. That's exactly right. They are religious-type inquisitions because people who take opiates are unpredictable dope fiends. They're liable to do anything. And that's very similar to the Salem witch trials, by the way. Well, just Salem, it was 22 different towns in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Imagine this. You're living in these teeny-weeny towns, right, in 1690, and you decide to hang one of your neighbors because you are so fearful that they're possessed and will possess you. So I think a lot of fear is that people think, you know, their sons and daughters are going to become addicts or possessed, when in fact some might, and some might get leukemia, and some teenagers may be killed by drunk drivers, and some teenagers may develop brain tumors and other horrible things. But, you know, we have to understand that this is not a different disease. It doesn't need to be categorized as a demonic disease, because it's not. It's a real disease, and people deserve compassion, just like the AIDS epidemic. You know, everybody didn't want to touch anybody with AIDS. They don't want anybody moving in the neighborhood with AIDS, you know, because it's a moral disease, right? Because it was associated with homosexuality. So it became a moral disease. And that's the same problem when people view people with type B addiction. Type B addiction is a real disease. People become accidentally addicted. Type A, people go out and seek to get high on purpose, and they may want to get high because they feel crappy. I remember they asked Kelsey Grammer, who was a heavy drug user, said, why'd you do this, Kelsey? And he kind of just smiled and said, because it made me feel good. You know, and he was a type A. He wasn't a type B, a narcotics addict or a opiate addict. He was a type A, and this is the person you hear about. First it was cocaine, then it was alcohol, then it was weed, then it was... That's the type A addicted person. Type B people do use other drugs, but they have a more severe. When you take a type A person and put them in rehab, they have a pretty good chance of improving. You take a person with opiate addiction, put them in rehab, 90% of them fail. So the government is just wasting their money. These rehab facilities are not regulated. They don't have standards. They can do whatever they want. They can close the doors. And a lot of them are very nasty and punitive. That's a pretty awful thing to do to somebody with a disease. The average person with type B addiction, opiate addiction, when you ask them, if you had to do it over again, would you rather have not done this? And most all of them say yes. If you take somebody who's been smoking marijuana for the last year and you say, would you do this over again? Most of them say yes, because they did it on purpose. So we have to understand this is a different, it's choice for type A and not choice for type B. And type B is a more serious disease, and we need to start controlling by educating kids so that they can warn the families and warn the school when somebody is really going on a magic carpet ride that this is the first sign of a serious disease. One addict I talked to when he was 14 had a few beers, and within 3 days he was looking for whiskey. You can actually trigger an opiate addiction with alcohol as well, which is sort of odd. And then he just ended up on the streets. His life just fell apart at age 15 and he started sneaking around. And, you know, this is a terrible, terrible disease. But it needs to go back into the medical model. Right now it's in the criminal model. It needs to go back as it was in 1915 when doctors treated addicted people. Addicts call themselves addicts, so it's okay to say that. Believe it or not, the number of addicts in 1920, if you do it by population, you know, per 1,000 people, it's exactly the same as it is today. So how come we don't have more addicts? You read it in the news. Oh, there's more overdose deaths and more addicts. That's not true. Nobody has presented data from the government that the number of people with addiction disease has increased. Only the overdose deaths amongst the addicts.
Do you think, Dr. Klein, that the overdoses that are happening, is it because of the illicit fentanyl that's being put into the heroin?
No, it's the same reason. Since 1970, we've had deaths in the opioid, in the addiction community, and it's always due to a variety of drugs. The problem is this is a serious disease, and people who are not treated in 1915, they were treated with IV morphine, and now we're using medically assisted treatment. That's the same thing. You know, this is how you need to treat the disease. If you don't treat it, then people are just going to get whatever they can. So fentanyl has now replaced heroin in a lot of cities. A lot of cities, you can't find heroin. So people are obviously using fentanyl correctly on the streets. And you make mistakes with fentanyl just like you can make mistakes with heroin, like you can make mistakes when you start trying to take all these other drugs to improve your high. And heroin addicts do get high. That's part of the disease, though. So fentanyl, yeah, the epidemic is blamed on fentanyl. Let's see, it was blamed on nurse practitioners. It was blamed on doctors for prescribing too many drugs. It was blamed on pharmaceuticals for the OxyContin. It's the list of quote, causes of the epidemic and crisis is pretty long. It's basically like the little kid that's blaming everybody down the street, you know, because he did something wrong. The real culprit, if you had to identify a culprit, would be what was the real beginning of all this? It was the federal government arresting doctors, making heroin illegal, taking addiction B, opiate addiction, out of the hands of doctors and into the hands of the federal drug police.
Yeah, I don't know.
The United States.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
The United States, according to the congressional research folks, were very, very, highly esteemed service at the National Library of Medicine, says we have now spent $1,000 billion. That's $1 trillion. On the drug wars. There have been five, started with Eisenhower, Reagan, Nixon, Bush, and now the current president. We've spent $1 trillion. So if you sit down, you say, okay, so where are we? And then you listen to the news, most opioid deaths ever, you know, worst addiction ever, which isn't true, worst crisis ever. Now, wait a minute. We just spent $1,000 billion to fix this, and it's not fixed. I mean, this is kind of like third grade math.
And they're asking for more money. I think a lot of this is a money grab by certain industries that are going to benefit. And I think the current administration actually did dole out, I think it was tens of billions of dollars to the addiction industry. And I think that includes like the drug testing companies and that sort of thing.
Everybody's cleaning up. You know, they're all standing in line to get more federal money. They get $25 million here in North Carolina to do. I don't know. It's funny. I read the newspapers back in 1950, the New York Times, which you can now get online. And it's the same thing, the exact same thing. We need more police. We need more education. And we need more treatment facilities. And then the next step is we don't have enough money for these treatment facilities. They're unregulated and they charge $1,000 a day. You know, I go online with any kind of opiate topic on Google and I get about 42 ads for rehab facilities. You see, rehab is redemption. It's a redemption of the sin. People pay anything for it. Yeah. I mean, like you said, this has got religious overtones. This is like a religious inquisition because of the unpredictability, and that's immoral. It's immoral to be unpredictable, just like in Reefer Madness, and if people haven't seen the movie, get it. You can get it on Netflix, 1936, Reefer Madness.
It's hilarious.
It's hilarious. But you know, Brad, that got stitched into our fabric. You see, that's what the average person has, this unmitigated fear, and they don't know what it is. Well, that's part of the problem, you know, because these people are unpredictable. They were shooting people, running over people on the street. The girls were all turning into prostitutes. The boys all turning into, you know, aggressive sex fiends. It's a funny movie, but it's really kind of something we all need to watch and understand. This is why we believe this. This is why we are afraid and why politicians are afraid, because their constituents are afraid. I talked to one U.S. representative who's been a representative for 20 years, and he said, Dr. Klein, what you say makes sense. But he said, you haven't gone to all the funerals I have. So you see, it's a real grassroots thing. When you see a nice teenager who was a straight-A student in football, now dead, you know, because didn't know how to use heroin, well, that's ignorance. It's the same ignorance about AIDS and using condoms. It's the same ignorance. We don't want to talk about it because we think it's immoral. We, you know, teenage pregnancy. When I was in high school, if a young woman got pregnant, she'd disappear from high school. It kicked her out. And then where'd she go? She went to some criminal abortionist and a lot of times died because we were ignorant. And we're ignorant about the issue of type B addiction. Type A is a different story. If people want to go out and do those kinds of things, that's fine. But we're not so much afraid of people smoking weed. We're afraid of the dope addict, the heroin addict, the opiate addict. And that's what we have to understand is less dangerous than all the others. It's still difficult to treat. But you can die from it. Yeah, you can die from cocaine and amphetamines too. As a matter of fact,
alcohol,
death from cocaine is awful, and nobody ever talks about the numbers for deaths from cocaine. It's a moral issue. Go ahead, Brad.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Klein. How does cocaine? How does that actually cause somebody to die? Like, is it heart?
Well,
is it cardiovascular?
Cocaine is got some relationship with amphetamines. Amphetamines and cocaine raise your blood pressure.
Oh, okay.
And they make your heart rate go up, and they cause arrhythmias, irregular heartbeats. And both of them can turn you into a real crazy person. They can make a drug-induced psychosis. That never happens with opiates. Never. Only with cocaine and amphetamines. I think the methamphetamine and cocaine, should be the focus of more efforts, because those are really dangerous drugs. Now, they said at one point in Wall Street, everybody was snorting cocaine at lunch, and it was probably true. But again, it's education. You know, kids aren't stupid in high school, but if you start lying to them, like if you start lying to kids that sex isn't wonderful, then they're not going to believe anything you say. So if you go in and say, hey, you know, the solution to this is don't take drugs, they're not going to buy that. What you need to do is have some folks who have addiction disease come and talk to the kids and not say to them, you know, my life went down the toilet. They can say to them, you know, I developed a serious addiction disease when I was 16 and I took one oxycodone tablet. You see the ignorance of the legislators trying to control the epidemic by giving a prescription for only 7 days. It ain't going to work.
That's insane. That's insane.
It's not going to work. And it makes it tough on us doctors, you know, because what, everybody with a trauma in the emergency room gets 7 days? You know, I'm a doctor. You know, I see people, you know, in these horrible car wrecks and stuff. They're not going to be better in 7 days.
Yeah,
but if we give too much, you see, it's the too much principle.
Gotcha.
If you give too much, you're going to overdose and die. So I asked three doctors, all of which have been practicing pain medicine for more than 30 years, and that's a total of 100 years experience. These are huge practices. How many of your patients have overdosed and died? The answer was zero.
Wow.
Zero. How many became addicted? The most they could come up with, very rare. So all you got to do is ask people, you know, people in the communities who are being treated by doctors are not going to overdose. As a matter of fact, Vicodin and oxycodone have pretty safe limits. You can actually take quite a bit extra and nothing happens, you know, and then handing out Narcan to people on prescription drugs when nobody's going to die from an overdose, all that does is make people frightened.
And it sells more Narcan, right?
Sells more Narcan, $135 a crack. If you want to be giving out Narcan, you need to go into the community of addiction, or type B addiction, and give them Narcan and give them Ambu bags, which you could buy for $20. I learned in medical school. An Ambu bag is like a football. It's always open. So it has a little mask. You put the mask over somebody's face, and then you squeeze the football. And then when you take your hand off, it pops open and draws in air. So you can breathe for somebody for a week, $20. How about fentanyl strips? You can check for fentanyl with a strip, like one you use in your aquarium. Are those being given out? Clean needles have failed. And plus, you can clean them out with Clorox. Is anybody teaching the addicts that? Is there a website that the people with addiction disease can go to learn more about, you know, what they're doing and the mistakes they're making? They're pretty good pharmacologists, but they make mistakes. And that's how they die. They make mistakes. And they die from suffocation, which can be treated with a $20 bag and mask. Heroin addicts, serious. And by the way, the addicts refer to themselves as junkies. I was talking to one guy the other day, and he said this friend of his would have died had he not been with an experienced junkie. So, you know, you need a buddy system like you do with airplanes, you know, wingman. And in the pool, when you go swimming, you always have a buddy. You should always have a buddy if you're in the community. And I think if the community understood and tried to help out and promulgate public health policies, right now there's none. There's just none. If you're on the streets with this terrible disease, you've got nobody to turn to. And then they've got these big computers to catch the doctor shoppers, you know, like they're atomic spies.
And the pharmacies are involved too now. That's they're acting as spies for the government, basically.
They are, and they don't like it, most of them. Most of them do not like it. The DEA's forced them to report. And, of course, the DEA thinks the pharmacists are a part of the problem, and they think drug distributors are part of the problem, and doctors are part of the problem. Everybody's part of the problem. And, of course, the problem was making the drugs illegal. So, you know, up comes the topic of making drugs legal.
Like Portugal did?
Yes, like Portugal. And what happened to the crime rate in Portugal? Practically disappeared. Do you think they've got cartels in Portugal? No. You think they're arresting doctors in Portugal? No. Switzerland also, partially in the UK. In the UK, if you're a heroin addict, they give you a little bag of pure heroin, you know how many milligrams it is, in a syringe, and you go home and inject yourself, and you come back in a month. See, that's medicated-assisted treatment. You basically can take a person with type B addiction disease, or what we call chemical receptor disease, and you can use any opiate. I mean, you could give enough oxycodone that you could hold off the addiction. The way we treat addiction is we cover enough of what is needed to prevent people from getting high. And if they want to get high, then that's a choice. But if they're just going to get enough so they can live, stories of people being on medication for their addiction, it's just wonderful, really. They talk how they get their lives back together. Nobody knows they're on it. They can't tell they're on it themselves. They can go work. You know, it's actually safe to drive a car. You can have a normal life, you know, with these replacement drugs. But the politicians, oh my God, that's, you're giving dope to a dope fiend? Are you nuts?
You're helping the sinner sin.
Helping the sinner sin. That's right. You are facilitating this horrible sin. And really, when you look back through the history, it's all about sex, immigrants, black folks, Chinese, Mexicans. You know, kind of a similar theme we see today, only it had to do with dope fiends. So we need some education in schools, too. They're doing better with sex education. They're doing better with AIDS education and understanding of people of different sexual backgrounds. But this is the one thing we've got left. And we need to do it. And people like you, Brad, can help with this. Because we need to start getting the facts down. And yeah, the teachers may not want to do it, but too bad. You got to talk about sex, and you got to talk about being gay or lesbian, and you got to talk about the AIDS virus.
Yeah, definitely. I think education, like you talked about, is the number one thing, because when you're fed propaganda and you're fed these lies that help other people profit off the misery of other people, it's really a sad state of affairs. And the Nixon administration, this guy came out and he was in the part of the administration, and he said why they went for the war on drugs was partly because you couldn't lock up somebody for being black or for being an anti-war protester, but you could lock people up for possession of drugs. And I think we're still kind of in that phase where the people who don't fit into the establishment are still targeted in that way.
Very good, Brad. Actually, John Ehrlichman confessed in 1994 to those exact that exact analysis. Nixon was trying to get left-wingers, and so he picked marijuana and then made these horrible fines. Black folks, it was cocaine. Yeah, and then you could bust up a political rally, and all you got to do is find, you know, one little bag of marijuana or a little bit of cocaine, and off to the federal prisons you go, you know, for these huge sentences. And by the way, when doctors are convicted of these crimes, they get the same sentences that you would get if you were a drug cartel.
I had no idea about that. That is so wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I hear of doctors getting prison terms of like 10 years. You know, because they made a mistake and gave some drugs to an undercover agent. The DEA sends out undercover agents. You know, the infractions of most of the cases that I read are pretty borderline. The DEA pulls 35 licenses out of a million people a year because they're crooks, real crooks. But they get 600 licenses a year by what's called voluntary surrender. They frighten the doctor so much that they voluntarily give up their rights, and they voluntarily give up their DEA licenses. And they said, well, you can practice medicine. You just won't be able to prescribe any controlled substances. And the doctor, the poor feckless doctor, says, okay. And then the Board of Registration and Medicine in the state says, you just confessed to a drug crime. Guess what? We're taking your general medical license away. Now you do Uber. Sell tomatoes. I don't know.
Yeah, it's
chop firewood.
That, you know, maybe we'll get back to that, right? Of doctors doing medicine with barter instead of paying through insurance companies.
Yeah, you know, that would solve a lot of problems, Brad. I'll tell you, I got a wood pile out back, sort of my security blanket.
You never know if we're going to need that.
That's I start selling the stuff in my front yard, you know, $5 a bushel, $5 a little rack of put plastic around it.
I don't think you need a license to do that. I'm not sure.
No, you don't. And you'd be safe, you know. It's like a lot of doctors really just want to go live in a tent. There's a lot of doctors dropping out completely. 60% of doctors in the past 2 years have stopped prescribing pain medicine.
Yeah, I went to a doctor, and the first time I saw him, because I'd left my other GP, and I, been sick for 30 years, had a bunch of surgeries and stuff, and, I've had these terrible issues, and, you know, his first thing is that I just met you, that was one of his lines, and he said, I said about my pain, he said, if it's from scar tissue or surgery, he's like, I'm not going to take responsibility for that. But if it's Crohn's, I will. And I thought, I have one body. You know, my surgeon won't help me. And now you're telling me you won't help me as well. And if nobody's ever been in that position, it's very dehumanizing. It's you feel like you don't have any power over your life at all. Your power is in the hands of somebody who could care less about you.
It's bad. I think one of the worst things in life in general for kids, teenagers, adults, is to be accused of something you haven't done. It's a terrible thing. And so basically the doctor's accusing you of being a drug seeker.
That's what he said to me. He
said dope fiend.
Yeah, exactly.
Unpredictable dope fiend.
That's exactly what he said, Dr. Klein. I know we're getting a little past time here. I got a couple more questions, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay, excellent. You did write another article on Medium, and I think the way I read it, it was geared more towards the doctors. And in that article, you talked about, I believe it was palliative care certificates.
Yes.
And I've never heard of those, and I've been sick for 30 years. Could you explain that to the audience?
Well, palliative care was invented in England, and then it came to the U.S. There's a little history of it in there. Palliative care is nothing more than taking care of people's pain, discomfort, when you can't treat the underlying disorder. Now, that happens a lot in medicine. I see people with horrible arthritis. They got too many joints involved to go get them all replaced, and the drugs don't work. What are you going to do? Just going to let them lay there in a chair where they can't move because all their joints hurt? So that's technically palliative care. Palliative care is not magical. It just means you can't treat the underlying disorder. You have to treat the symptoms. It may be that people with TB have intractable coughing. They can't stop coughing, so you can give medicines to stop the cough. If they have horrible diarrhea, you can give medicines to stop the diarrhea, even though you can't cure the underlying disease. So that's all it is. It's confused with hospice, so I put in the definition that this might shorten somebody's lifespan. And people with chronic disease technically have a shortened lifespan. But it's symptoms. You treat the symptoms if it will improve a person's quality of life, and they have no cure for the underlying disease. It's real simple. People get confused and think that's a program. There are palliative care programs, but you can do it in the office. I do it with patients that I see. I give them a little certificate that I made up. And on it, it says you qualify for palliative care because in the first sentence of the CDC guidelines, it exempts people with palliative care from the entire guideline, all 50 single-spaced pages. It's in most all the state laws, it's exempted. So if it's in the law and it's exempted, it means doctors can treat people with any dose of medicine that they feel is appropriate because they have palliative care. They're protected by the law. And this simple fact is just not, people aren't grasping it. So I wrote that little article and I'm trying to get it published and having a hard time so people can just go on my Medium in the meantime and look at it. But it's a simple solution. In your case, Brad, the doctor could say, wait a minute, you qualify for palliative care because you've got an untreatable, untreatable condition, and if I treat you, your life is going to be better, and get the little certificate, and now everybody's protected. I mean, technically, you could take it to the pharmacy, too, and say, hey, what's going on here? I have palliative care status. It'll take a while to catch on, and a lot of people do get it confused with hospice, which is a federal program. Hospice is a program. When you're on hospice, you can't get regular medical care. If you have palliative care, you get all the care you want. When you send a bill into the insurance company, you send it in for chronic pain, and you can still get everything else you want. It's the old doctor treating compassionately, treating people with discomfort in the best way they can. And that's what we do a lot of times. You know, we see people all the time with these dreadful diseases and get cancer and leukemia and stuff. But, you know, we can make their life better. I mean, that's what medical marijuana is doing. It's helping out a lot to help with pain and suffering. Well, with the suffering part, it's no good for pain. So palliative care is really a big secret, and I'll just put in a little plug for it since I don't make any money on it. But you can get hold of the document simply by Googling Medium Palliative Care Kline, K-L-I-N-E. And if you stick the word form in there, palliative care form, you'll get a copy of the form and you can download it. And I suggest people send the article and the form to their doctor ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Don't take it in there and spring it on them, you know, when they got 8 minutes to see you.
Sure.
Send it in ahead of time in the mail, put a little sticker on, just for your information. Let the physicians read it, because I wrote the article for doctors to let them know they can make more money by charging for all the extra time they have to spend. A lot of doctors don't want to take pain patients because it takes so much time. I can't tell you how much time I spent on the phone with the pharmacists trying to figure out how to get around the insurance companies and the DEA, you know, that's made it so I can't call in prescriptions. We send prescriptions by courier. I send them overnight, all because the DEA believes that if I called in a prescription, I would be feeding more dope fiends. So yeah, palliative care, you know, it's until I get the thing published and, it's not getting wide circulation, but it's a very simple solution.
Well, I'll definitely put a link to it on the website, chronicallyhuman.co. So we'll definitely push that out there too as well. I just want to thank you for your time, Dr. Kline. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about? Maybe there was the FDA meeting on July 9th, I believe it is.
I'm glad you brought that up. I'm going to go there.
Okay, great.
And but you can go to this. I'm going to look up the quick link. Mm-hmm. You can, if you're a chronic pain person, you can go and just leave a little comment. The FDA is looking for comments from people with chronic disease that have been screwed, you know, by the system. And you can just leave. It's very simple. You go to the website, and here's the link. If you Google FDA 2018-N as in Nancy 1621, that's FDA 2018-N1621. It'll take you to the comment section, and you press a little button that says leave a comment, and leave comments. Just tell a little story about how your life has been ruined by doctors not wanting to give you pain medicine, for God's sake. You know, pain.
And I did leave a comment myself, and it's really easy to do. And
okay.
And I think by law they have to read those. I'm not sure
they do. And no, and I've heard from people in the government, they actually read every single one.
That's fantastic.
So it's not a waste of time at all.
What are you going to be doing there at the meeting? Are you going to be speaking?
Well, it's a kind of free for all. It's mainly for chronic pain patients with, and we need to stop using that term. People, I think, when you tell somebody I have chronic pain, they think you've got some mysterious, oh, yeah, right, you got pain. Painful disease.
I like that better.
Painful diseases.
Right.
Diseases with pain components. Right. You know, that's really what it is. And like I said, everybody I've run across has got a real disease. You know, they're not going, oh, it just comes out of the blue. Yeah, and they're listening. So I've signed up. I'm going to drive down there, and I don't even know if I'm going to have a chance to speak. But usually when I go to these things, I learn things, too, by listening to people and what they have to say. But it's FDA is the only regulatory agency with what's called rulemaking, which means they are the only ones that can write new rules for opiates, not the CDC, not state governments, not Medicare, only the FDA. And so far, they're holding to the line that doctors can prescribe as much as needed. The 90 milligram cutoff is fake.
Why do you think that came out by the CDC? Were they looking for to increase their revenue or some?
No. It's zealots.
Okay, zealots.
Addicts. You know, one FDA official said that the group that brought all this to the CDC and wrote the regulations were lunatic fringe. And I agree.
I agree, too. Some of the stuff on Twitter from certain people who are psychiatrists who got into this, I mean, it's absolutely, it's almost like it's a psychopath. Psychopathy of some type of going at this. It really is amazing that people can have so little compassion or even common sense about the suffering that others have.
Yep. It goes back to our Puritans. You know, if you didn't toe the mark, they would just cast you out and shun you, well, sometimes even hang you. The church had the right to hang people. And that's, by the way, why we have separation of church and state in our Constitution, because of the pilgrims' religious courts, where they could actually hang. They did. They hung Quakers. You know, you're like you said, you're unpredictable. You're a Quaker. You're not, oh, my God, you're not doing what we do, and you don't believe the way we do. Let's just hang you.
Well, Quakers were too peaceful, I think, for people. So they didn't want to join in on, I think, taking the Indian land and stuff like that.
Yep.
but what do you think, Dr. Klein, about decriminalization or ending prohibition totally and finding a new system to sell drugs? Because alcohol is a drug, you know, caffeine's a drug, so that are currently illegal. What kind of system would you think? Is it the Portugal model, or is there something else that we can do better?
That's a good question, and I don't have an answer because I'm still – I'm soliciting information from people. As soon as you talk about decriminalization, the politicians all break out in a cold sweat.
Right.
So it has to be framed differently.
Okay.
Some kind of controlled, using the word control in there somewhere.
They like that.
You know, yeah, controlled. I don't know. See, so let's work on that, Brad. You've got a great idea. And the people that watch your podcast, you know, if they want to email me or go on Twitter or something, I'm looking for ideas about how we can do this. We need to stay away from the words decriminalization and stuff like that.
Legalize, they don't like that.
And do it slowly. You know, it's got to be done slowly. We're doing it with marijuana.
Right. At the state level, I think that might be the gateway to push all this back.
Yeah. So make it, well, I say the medical model. We need to put people back in the medical model that doctors treat. And there's some good examples of that, and get it out of the hands of the federal drug police and let them go after real criminals and terrorists and things that they're better suited to do.
I definitely agree with that. Definitely. Well, let's end on that, Dr. Klein. I really appreciate all your work you're doing and your time today. Is there anything else that you'd like to say to the audience or anything that comes to mind that looks like there's two sides of this. There's the addiction side and there's the chronic pain side. And the addiction side is what gets blown out of proportion.
Right. The two are linked together, you see, because people are not treating chronic pain because they're afraid of addiction.
Gotcha.
So, you know, in other words, you have to they're first cousins, you know, and you have to kind of look at them together. They're both diseases that require opiates. So that is one thing that they share. But thank you, Brad, for having me on, and it's time for my donuts.
Well, excellent, Dr. Klein. Well, you have a great day. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.